Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. As President Donald Trump continues to upend politics, causing shock and awe around the world, we keep wondering what'll come next. Amid the ructions, there's been a lot of pushback. One of Trump's critics has been the former US ambassador to Australia, Jeffrey Bleich, who was stationed in Canberra during the Obama years. He's been back in Canberra this week, where he addressed the university's Australia conference, and he joins us today. Jeffrey Bleich, let's start with education. There's starting to be a lot of talk about the role of universities during a time of disruption, including backlash against experts. How much of a battering are the universities in for, and how should they react?
Michelle, it's nice to be back with you in Australia. I actually think that universities will demonstrate their worth during a time like this. I think the fact that there is real disruption in technology and in the economy and in how people are ordering their lives means they need a better direction on the skills that they'll require for the jobs of the future, and they're also going to need some visionaries who can help them chart that course. And so universities, I think, will really demonstrate their importance. And I don't expect that people who come up with good ideas will be rejected. I think they'll be appreciated.
To put it really bluntly, is Donald Trump any threat to universities in America?
No. I mean, I think that President Trump has a skepticism about experts, a skepticism about the value of internationalism and the more esoteric aspects of education. But he's a product of Wharton Business School. I mean, he understands the importance of education, and the people who he has appointed to some key positions were also products of America's finest universities. So I don't expect that it will be an attack on universities per se. I think there is an attack on what he would characterize as elites. And that, I think, is a convenient term to identify people whose point of view he disagrees with strongly.
It's a funny notion, this one of elites and attacks on the elites, isn't it? Because, of course, the people doing the attacking are part of the elite.
Well, yeah, when you have a cabinet full of billionaires, generally people think if you come from wealthy families and you've got billions of dollars, you're part of the elite. I think that has been part of the success of President Trump, is his ability to be part of the elite without seeming to be, because of the way he talks, the way he conducts himself. There is a guy at the end of the bar popping off quality to him, which many people who are skeptical of elites find familiar and compelling.
Let's just turn to the Australian-American relationship. The belligerent phone call between Donald Trump and Malcolm Turnbull made for a very spectacular story in the Washington Post. How strong was the reaction to that story in the United States?
It's interesting. I think the reaction to the story was one that was very helpful to Australia, because one person after another, myself included, was called onto TV to talk about it. And everyone said, well, if this conversation is what the Washington Post reports, what do you think? And we all said the same thing, which is that Australia is one of our best friends in the world. It's a critical country. Look at all the things that we do together and that Australia has done over the years. And it was actually an opportunity to reinforce the importance of this alliance and the importance of Australia. And I'd say that the reaction within the White House was to say, well, it was a positive conversation, and we're not going to poke a finger in the eye of our friends. And the deal that was being discussed was actually maintained by the new Trump administration. So I think it had a positive effect for Australia in an ironic way.
Now, of course, the president reluctantly reaffirmed that deal about taking refugees from our offshore processing areas. But do you think that in the end this will be delivered? Because no one has yet gone. The vetting process seems a pretty slow one. There's talk of the, of course, of extreme vetting. Do you think it'll just go on and on with delays and nothing much will come of it?
Yeah, well, I can't predict how this will play out. But you have a number of people who, as I understand it, have been at Manus Island for a long time and have been carefully vetted. I would hope that as long as we are faithful to the rules for refugee vetting and admission, that, you know, they should be able to get through in relatively, you know, expeditious fashion. And if they don't, I'm sure that there will be lawyers who are prepared to step up and make the case for them. And I do have a lot of confidence in our courts.
More broadly, where do you think the Trump presidency leaves the Australian-American alliance? There's been a lot of talk about the fact that the alliance is based in much more than the relationships between any particular government and US administration. But does it really create problems for this alliance?
Well, it's been interesting. I've spent the last few days here in Australia, and I'd say there's a much higher degree of uncertainty about America's path forward than I recall there being. And I also think that there is a good deal of vocal disappointment in some of the policies that we have heard announced. They haven't gone into place, but heard announced by this administration. But, you know, I think it really does two things. One is it turns the conversation to what matters, what the values are that we share. And why there's disappointment is because America has always been one of the great advocates for those values. And so, if anything, I think it's been helpful to get us back to basics, to refocus on what matters. I think it's also been very good that Australians have been speaking very candidly about this because, you know, if you think your friend is making a mistake, you don't abandon them as a friend. You talk to them about it. And I think it reaffirms the closeness of the relationship.
Well, the Turnbull government thinks that you talk to them very quietly if you talk to them at all. Earlier this year, you criticised the president's executive order on immigration and you attacked those who'd remained silent on it. Our government, our prime minister, did not criticise it. Do you think that was a mistake?
No. I mean, my statement was really about Americans. Americans have a responsibility to stand up for American values, and I think we have a vital responsibility to speak out when we think our government is doing the wrong thing. That's what free speech is all about. And it wasn't something that I looked forward to or took any joy in, but it was, to me, one of the things that you do as a citizen of your country. For a foreign leader, I think they need to first and foremost advance the interests of their own country. And so if the government thinks that, you know, by condemning the president's actions, it may interfere with their ability to do other things that are important for Australia's national interests, then you know, I think that's what a leader's supposed to do, is make those judgments.
On the other hand, if another country doesn't stand up for its values and if it goes silent in the hope of future favours, surely it may be just taken for granted in the future and also be seen to be selling out on its own principles.
No, I mean, I think there are different messages that can be delivered that don't necessarily attack policies of the U.S., but reaffirm Australian values. And I think, you know, in this case, you could say, well, for one thing, if the reports of the conversation are true, then the government probably did a pretty good job of negotiating if the U.S. felt that Australia got the better end of the deal. But on the other hand, Australia can also reaffirm its own values in connection with the treatment of those who, you know, are just seeking a better life, who are being driven from their home countries and are homeless because of the ravages of despots or other blights on their lives in their home countries and need a place. You know, we both our nations of immigrants. Unless you are 100% Aboriginal or 100% Native American, then you come from immigrants somewhere in your bloodline.
Now, the executive order on immigration has since been stayed by the courts. What chance do you think that President Trump will, in the end, win through on the legal arguments with this order?
Well, as I said in my post, I do not believe that the executive order was legal, and the courts appear to have agreed with me on that. It was rejected by judges who were appointed by both Democrats and Republicans, affirmed by the Court of Appeal. I think it's much more likely that the Trump administration will go back to the drafting board and come up with a new ban that they believe will survive a constitutional review, and that's the way our system's supposed to work. I may not like the policy, but at the very least, it needs to comply with U.S. law.
The new administration must be having immense rippling effects through the American bureaucracy. How do you think it's affected the operations of the State Department and its relationship with other countries?
Well, there are two things. One is we're very early into the administration, and so there haven't been any specific things done in the sense that there hasn't been a budget, there hasn't been anything other than trial balloons thrown out publicly about possibly reducing the budget of the State Department and USAID or eliminating, you know, entire agencies or groups in the government. But at this point, it's mostly uncertainty. I'd say the biggest challenge is that the administration has been very, very slow to fill positions. There are 4,000 positions that the president has to fill, and among those, 535 or so are Senate confirmed. And so normally, you know, you would have about 1,500 nominations out there now, and virtually all of the Senate confirmed ones within the first, you know, few months. In this case, you know, I think there have been a total of 26 announced, only 15 or 16 confirmed with the confirmation of the Commerce Secretary. And so all of the deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, where a lot of the work gets done, just haven't been filled. And so that is a substantial drag on top of the uncertainty about what the policies ultimately will be.
And what about the ambassadors? Because you have many political appointments here, and they were all brought back, weren't they, at the start?
Yes, in fact, the White
Obama
House,
ones.
Yeah, all the Obama ambassadors who were politically appointed, not career foreign service, were told they needed to be back by noon on Inauguration Day. So by the time Donald Trump put his hand on the Bible, they needed to have vacated the residence.
They put their hands on the suitcase.
They had to put their hands on the suitcase. That's exactly right.
And is there a big gap here now, or are people starting to be appointed out into these posts?
No, relatively few. There's been an announcement for China, for the UK, for Israel, a handful of other countries, but not in the traditional way in which these are rolled out. And again, very hard for people to do their job as ambassador unless they know, you know, who the secretary and deputy secretary and assistant secretary is for their region, because you want to coordinate with them. You want to have a coordinated policy and not have ambassadors just kind of popping off with their own vision of foreign policy.
So do you think that the other major powers, Russia and China, are taking advantage of this hiatus, this uncertainty around American policy?
I'm sure that leaders in those countries are seeing this as an opportunity. Whenever there's a transition, a new president gets tested. When a new president comes in a country that is as deeply divided right now as the United States is, between rural and urban communities and between Democrats and Republicans. If you look at the polling, it's extraordinarily stark. President Trump has nearly 90% approval rating among Republicans and below 8% among Democrats, which is very unusual for this early in administration. It actually puts his numbers lowest of any modern president in terms of approval ratings. And the cities of the United States overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton, and the rural communities voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. So when you're that divided, other countries look and say, there may be an opportunity here. My sense, though, is that, America always eventually comes together. We came together after a civil war. And if you can come together after that, you can come together after anything.
But nevertheless, do you think this division will last a long time and will perhaps get worse before that coming together happens?
I'm optimistic in that I believe that this is a major shock to the system that is going to force all Americans to revisit what we're all about, what our Constitution sets forth for us as our common values. So, for example, we commit to free speech and freedom of the press. The statements about trying to shut down the press and tell them to stop reporting things. I think there will be a public debate that you see that is very robust right now about what that means. Same thing with the Muslim ban that was announced during the campaign, and then this executive order which targeted certain countries. It produced just an enormous outpouring of lawyers and protesters and public comment, unprecedented for the last 30 years. And I think each one of these things, which challenges a core American value, is going to force us to really remember why we believe in these virtues.
So how would you describe the mood in America these days among, say, middle class people who are doing reasonably but are concerned about their futures? What's their feeling about the sort of society they're living in under the Trump presidency?
Yeah, I think there are, the average middle class family really divides very much between Republican and Democrat and rural and urban. I would say that for everyone, there's a sense that the level of tension that has been created and the constant rollout and tweets of challenging statements from the administration and the reaction to them is unsustainable. You can't have 48 months where people are on edge every time their CNN alert goes off. So I think there's a sense that we're all bound by the fact that we don't want to be feeling this much pressure all the time. I do think that among people who have seen their quality of life, being more challenged, they have to work longer hours. Both members of the household have to work in order to make ends meet. They're going into debt. They wanted someone to turn back the clock and, start bringing back jobs from the 50s, coal jobs and mill jobs, and sort of reject the new technologies and the orthodoxy of an international liberal order. And they're, I think, optimistic but anxious about what's going to replace all that. I think the people who are in more progressive communities, particularly in cities, are upset, angry, believe that this is a fundamental violation of American values, and they are taking to the streets in unprecedented numbers. I mean, these protests that spontaneously grew all over the country were you know, were just that. They were spontaneous, and they say something about the mood of people in these cities.
Is there a feeling of disbelief that all this could be happening in America, which has been seen in the past as a place where so many people wanted to go and which had many, many special qualities, including political qualities? Yeah.
Well, you know, America is still America. Like, I'm saying exactly what I believe, you know, in the media. I'm not afraid about, you know, my ability to move around and live my life. I think the notion that America, based on, one election, will lose its core, will lose its value system, I don't believe that. I think what this does is it forces us to reclaim that value system. And so I think people are surprised and shocked around the world. But I think, and I think Americans are surprised. But on the other hand, they're not just passively saying, well, okay, it's a whole new America now. They're saying, you know, some people are saying, we didn't become great by abandoning our values. We became great by fighting for them.
Do you think President Trump will certainly last his full 4-year term, or do you think there's the slightest chance that he could be impeached?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard thing to predict. My sense is that, you know, people should expect that presidents will serve their at least one full term in office. The only reason that he would be impeached is if, you know, there's evidence of, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors. I'd say the for people who are thinking in those terms, and I think including on his side, people who are worried about ensuring that he has a full 4 years, their greatest concern is potential conflicts of interest because he hasn't stepped away from his business relationships, and members of his cabinet still have, you know, potential challenges in the same respect. But for him, you know, there is a question about conflicts of interest. And of course, there's a number of investigations, including a Senate investigation that's bipartisan relating to engagements with Russia. So those would be the only areas that I could see people on his side being worried that he needs to get straight so as not to potentially compromise his presidency.
Also looking ahead, do you think his rusted-on supporters will become critical anytime soon? And is there a possibility that there could be a severe backlash at the congressional elections in a couple of years' time?
Well, he's made some very, very bold promises. You know, he talked about, bringing back all sorts of jobs to communities that, are feeling left behind. But, you know, the reason that coal mining coal has been going away is not because of environmental regulations or because of globalization. It's because natural gas is a cheaper and more efficient fuel source, and it's just displaced coal. And the reason that steel mills have gone away is because businesses around the world have recognized that there are less expensive places to do that work. The U.S. is uniquely positioned to, you know, do advanced manufacturing, but not sort of traditional manufacturing. And so, he's promised to, dramatically, increase the revenues because there's going to be so much wealth coming into the country he'll be able to pay for an enormous infrastructure bill and huge defense spending and large border protection. These are very, very big calls. And if he's not able to deliver new jobs and he's not able to avoid dramatically increasing the debt, I think there'll be a backlash, yes.
Obviously, the Democrats were totally shocked and quite devastated by the Clinton loss because it was so unexpected, I guess.
Yeah.
But do you think that the president's behavior, in fact, could make it easier for the Democrats to regroup quite quickly?
Oh, I think Democrats, if they've learned any lesson from this, it's not to underestimate the capacity of Donald Trump to, you know, hold together his base and in some cases build on it, notwithstanding his public comments, and maybe in part because of them. And so I think Democrats, instead of thinking we're going to win because Trump will trip up, need to think much more in terms of what is it about our vision that we have failed to articulate, or that is not it's not compelling. Maybe we haven't really gotten the answer for the public in terms of what is a positive vision for going forward. The, you know, the president's vision is very much, let's go backwards. Let's, you know, roll back the administrative state. Let's roll back civil rights regulations. Let's roll back other forms of regulations, including environmental protections. Let's roll back the kinds of jobs that America invests in, and really go back in time. And I think if Democrats want to be the party of going forward, they need to articulate that vision much more clearly.
Do you think the Democrats could have won with another candidate?
Oh, you know, everyone loves to play that game. And the counterfactuals are very hard to ever know. I'd say that it was very challenging for anyone who was an establishment figure to do well in this election cycle. Every establishment figure on the Republican side got clobbered. And really, at the end, it came down to the two people who were viewed as the most anti-establishment, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, on the Republican side, from a field of 16. And if you look at the Democrats, you actually started with three people who were seen as relatively traditional candidates: former governor of Maryland, Hillary Clinton, who had been a senator and secretary of state, and a senator from Maine, and former governor from Maine. And then you had Bernie Sanders, who was really seen as the outsider. And Bernie Sanders was the most compelling person in that race, too. So anyone who's an establishment figure, whether it was Hillary Clinton or someone else, is going to have a hard time winning in this environment. And she came incredibly close. She was within, 60,000 people had switched their votes across three states. She would be president of the United States. So it's, I think, you know, people who say, well, she was, you know, a candidate who couldn't possibly win, I think she did as well as any establishment candidate could have done.
So you say the Democrats will have to look for vision and put forward compelling policies next time round in the presidential election. But what sort of candidate will they have to put forward to defeat President Trump?
You know, these things tend to become more clear as the administration that's in office takes shape. So once people know where a president's weaknesses are, and where the public is dissatisfied, that tends to help identify who's going to be strongest on the other side. So, for example, after 2004, when George W. Bush won his second term in office, you know, no one was saying Barack Obama will be the presidential candidate in 4 years. They thought he's smart and talented. He had just been elected to the Senate. They thought maybe he would have two terms as senator, maybe a term as governor, maybe at that point, you know, 15 years from now, he'll be running for president. But there were qualities about Barack Obama that were compelling, and wherever he showed up, there were, you know, enormous crowds. And at some point, people said, this is what the country's hungry for in response to the current administration. I think probably in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months, we will start to see what kind of candidate is the right candidate for Democrats.
It's going to be a very compelling time for the Watchers of Politics. Jeffrey Blush, thank you very much for talking with us today, and it's good to see you back in Australia. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. That's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. We'll be back with you soon. Goodbye for now.
Just like